It's the only time you have control of Bob McCowan. Let's go. Subscribe to Primetime Sports Podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan. On demand. When the mic goes on, it's like ringing the dinner bell. Let the salivating begin. Bob McCowan and Primetime Sports. Dig in on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Hour 2 of 3. It's Primetime Sports, Canada's most listened to sports talk program on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Networks. I am Bob McCown. That is Ken Reed over there. This Matt Harvey story is interesting. We'll get to it in a little bit. Harvey missed a mandatory workout. He said because of traffic and then said, well, it really wasn't because of traffic. I just kind of forgot. Oops. Papelbon got 7 games. I think they should suspend him.
Yeah, that's going to happen.
Jim Duquette will join us in a bit from MLB Network, and Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe. Later, Ken Rosenthal from Fox, Don Banks from SI, and Cassie Campbell-Pascal of the NHL and Sportsnet. All coming up on the program. Tomorrow night, the Toronto Maple Leafs, kick save and a beauty, will tee up their 2015-16 season. And in general terms, you would have to concede, I think all would concede, that, you know, even the most diehard Leaf fans, that the expectations are pretty low. The bar has been set pretty low for this team. How do you deal with that if you are an executive with Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment? Our next guest is one of those. He is the general manager of the Toronto Maple Leafs. Here's Lou Lamoriello. Hello, Lou. How are you?
Hi, Bob. How are you?
Excellent. Thank you. You've been around this game a long time. You're still 24 hours, a little more than 24 hours away from kicking off this season. But it's a different environment, different job, different city, you know, historic franchise, yada, yada, yada. Does it feel any different?
Oh, absolutely. I think the apprehension or the excitement and just waiting to see and get to the first game where, you know, we find out who we are. Not that we're going to find that out in the first night, but just see where we are. I think so. All of those things are different where you come from knowing what to expect. I think that we're no different than maybe the fans. We really don't know. There's been a lot of changes, and it's an excitement. It's really positive.
Would you expect to be more active or less active as the season progresses in terms of making deals, moves, et cetera?
Bob, I don't think that's a question that we could answer at this point. I think we have to, you know, get into the season, see who we are and where we are after 10, 15 games,
right,
and make adjustments as you go along. But what we will do is do whatever is necessary to stay in the plan and to get better.
Those two, some would say, are different paths, you know, staying in the plan and getting better. Many people believe that the plan is to understand that you're probably not going to be very good this year, maybe even next year, but build towards something in the future. And you know yourself and watching from afar that this organization has gone down this road before, but hasn't maintained the discipline to be able to live this thing through. Which is it more likely? Is it stay the course?
It's stay the course, absolutely. But along the way, that doesn't mean you're not improving and you're making whatever transactions or moves that become available within the framework of that. You don't just sit back and allow things to go in a different direction. You control the direction it's going. And opportunities come about for different reasons, but there has to be a plan involved.
Lou, is part of that plan to bring along your young players slowly? We see a Michael Nylander going down to the minors, for example, and you guys signing some veterans to play at the start of the season?
I don't know if it's right to say bring them along slowly. I think it's bring them along, you know, to the point where they're ready to play. Now, if they go to the minors and they show us that they don't belong there and they're not going to get better during that competition, then you have to progress what maybe you felt was the time frame. They're going to determine that. It's developing them to the point that when they come here, they're going to have success. It's not hoping they have success. You know, and we'll find that out. I mean, we've all been around long enough to know when players are ready. Unfortunately, in this new day and age, we bring them up too early, hoping they're ready.
Are you hoping a young guy like Frank Corrado, who you picked up on waivers today, who's had some time up with Vancouver, do you believe he's ready for full-time duty in the NHL right now?
Well, I think that's something we're going to find out. We haven't had Frank here. Our scouts have certainly spent enough time, you know, in every situation with reference to potential players available, especially preparing for waivers. And he was a player that was highly talked about potentially if he came because of the way he played. We were all involved with it. He's 22 years old. He's a right shot defenseman. And there was really no risk involved with bringing him here as far as how he adjusts, as far as who he is. We're going to have to see them in this environment.
How much do you learn, Lou, in watching a team play in the early part of the season? I understand that there are limitations in what you can absorb during preseason games because of the nature of the games, because of the fact that you almost never have your entire roster on the ice in any one game. What's sort of the time frame that you think before you'll have be able to really evaluate what you have?
I wish I could put a time frame, but if you were pressed to do it, I'd say that you're talking between 10 and 20 games,
right,
to see exactly where the veterans are. And you said it best, Bob. You're playing in exhibitions games against, you know, 60% of an NHL roster. And when you have veterans, when you don't know them, you don't know if they're getting ready for the season. You know, even though, you know, Mike has put them through the paces, they've all responded, the work ethic is there, but you really don't know how they're going to handle and how they're going to accept, you know, that next step. I think that's an unknown. In fact, that's the anxieties that you have, you know, and you're hoping, and I hate that word, that, you know, their talents will come to the highest level, because Mike has done a tremendous job through a short period of time of getting them to have a consistent work ethic, at the same time trying to get them into a system that he feels is the way we're going to play, and yet still spread the players around so that they get ample exhibition time to see what they can do. But we won't know until we get into these games.
Leafs General Manager Lou Lamoriello is with us. You mentioned Mike Babcock. Now that you've had a chance to really get to know him, to see him as your head coach, you know, we have an image of what he did in Detroit and what his philosophies might be. Has there anything been surprising about the way Babcock handles his job?
Probably, for me, the most surprising thing is the amount of energy he has. From the first time you see him in the morning, no matter how early it is, and he's early, he's upbeat. He's positive. Nothing that went wrong the day before affects what he's doing today. I guess the best way to Mike is Mike's comfortable in his own skin. He knows what he's doing. He has confidence in what he believes, and he will get the players to believe in it, and he has done that. His hockey knowledge, his intelligence, we all know that. I mean, this is an intelligent
sure.
man, and I've really gained a tremendous amount of respect for him The way he really feels for people and understands, you know, the thought process that are going through players who are on the bubble, players who are young, and really gets to it. But separates that when he's coaching to win. When they're off the ice and he's communicating with them, he's talking to the person. He's talking to the feelings. He's getting right inside them to help them become better people. And along the way, certainly his role is to make them better players.
Lou, do you think there are certain players out there that, that could fit in well with a Mike Babcock, or does he change players into fitting in well with him?
Well, I feel that, you know, we're going to find out, and I think that this is what's very important, by having the group that we have here, who a lot were here last year, several have come in knowing Mike Babcock was here, of exactly how they respond to what's necessary. If you play well, you play. And I think that they, it's not an entitlement. It's not that you're going out there each and every night because, you know, you're a member of the team. So we're going to see how people respond to when they're not going there and the bench gets shorter. We're going to respond to, you know, who really is committed. These are unknowns. People fool you in a short period of time.
Yeah.
They're on their best behavior. It's going to be after a period of time that we find out, you know, about what we have and the direction we're going. We do know the direction. I want to be careful how I say that. It's just who wants to be a part of that.
Is that one of your biggest challenges as a GM, is just waiting it out and being patient?
Especially for someone who's impatient like me and Mike.
Right.
Let me ask you this about Mike. We know that Mike has a philosophy. He has a way he wants his team to play. But as you've watched him over the last couple of weeks, is he also a teacher? And what I mean is, when you have a group of inexperienced and or young players, and you have plenty of those, there are coaches that take the time, either individually or collectively, to still teach even at the NHL level. Is he that guy, or is his concentration principally, this is the philosophy of play that I want to instill on this group?
I would think that he's a teacher first. I think any good coach, any successful coach, is a teacher first, and then getting them to understand what you expect of them in the philosophy, the way you want them to play. Without question, he's a teacher. And he becomes a combination of both once he gets them to understand what his message is. That's the teaching part of it that you have to have. You can't expect or assume that they know what you want. And it's unfair to them because they've had many different coaches, and in a short period of time, you know, you have to teach.
This 3-on-3 is captured the imagination of a lot of people, myself included. I'm anxious to see it in real life. I'm intrigued by what is possible. Anything that eliminates night after night of shootouts is a good idea for me, because I can't stand the shootout as a way to determine the outcome of a hockey game.
We agree. Even though I can get in trouble for it, Bob, we agree.
Tell me what you've seen, because you've seen a lot more than I have. I've seen a few highlights, but tell me what you've seen and how much do you like it?
Well, first of all, what I have seen, I'm excited about it because of what you said earlier, that the game will be decided more towards what the game is, the hockey game.
Right.
Even though it's two people short, but what you will see in the regular season, and the expectations, I think, are very high, because you're going to see the top players on each team showing skill. And I think the statistics coming out of the preseason, you know, it's some 70% a result came about with the 3-on-3, and it all happened within under 3 minutes. I think it was 2:40, 2:45 of the 5-minute overtime that was experimental. So I think it's going to be extremely exciting. I think the fans are going to love it, you know, and, you know, hopefully I enjoy it.
It's going to be, as it always is, a long season. It may be longer than usual for Toronto Maple Leaf fans. We don't know yet, but we will begin to find out tomorrow night. Lou, we wish you the best of luck. And as always, we thank you for your time. We greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Bob and Ken. Always a pleasure.
We'll see you soon.
Bye, Lou.
Lou Lamoriello, the general manager of the Toronto Maple Leafs. It's going to be interesting.
I just worry about the three-on-three, about a coach eventually figuring out how to ruin it.
How?
I don't know.
Three guys.
I don't know yet. I'm not as smart as the coaches in the NHL.
Even if you put three, like I've heard some people say, you know, the other team puts out its three best forwards.
Mm-hmm.
No defensemen. They put out their three top scoring forwards. How do you combat that? And some people said, well, you put out three defensemen.
Or you put out your best three forwards. That would be the gutsy coach.
But that's right. What we want to see. Right. That's really what we expect to see.
Right.
If you take the opposite viewpoint, which is coaches always want to prevent goals and play defense and figure out a way to screw the system, do you do it by putting three defensemen on the ice?
Well, the beauty is, as far as I can tell, you can't clog up the neutral zone because there's not enough bodies to clog it up. But I'm sure there's a coach out there racking his brains right now trying to figure it out. I hope there isn't, but I think there probably is.
I just can't imagine how you can do it. Whether you get 70% success, I mean, I'd love 100.
I think
and Lou's obviously with me on that. He hates the shootout
you
as much as
both.
I do.
The shootout is entertaining, I think, for the fans that are in the arena.
No, but this will
because it's stand up and watch. But 3-on-3 is just
wait till they
fabulous.
See this.
Oh, I'm with you.
When
I'm
they
with
see
you.
This, they'll want to get rid of the shootout.
I'm with you, Bob.
And hopefully that happens. A most interesting twist as we get set for the postseason, which begins in a few hours from now. The Matt Harvey show has another chapter to it. The Mets pitcher missed a workout, said he was missing for one reason, found out he was missing for another reason. They haven't suspended him, but they have fined him. Jim Duquette of MLB Network joins us to talk a little bit about it. Hello, Jim. How are you?
Hey, what's going on, guys? How are you? I was not in charge of babysitting, I promise.
Well,
jeez, old man.
You know, it's just one thing after another with this guy, and I wasn't at the point where I really understood whether this was Matt Harvey or his agent or maybe even the New York Mets that were creating the ongoing issues. But this one's on Harvey, isn't it?
Yeah, this is definitely on Harvey. I mean, I can't even believe they can't even get the story straight. Like at first, it was the traffic. Then it was he got lost track of time. And then it was, okay, he called somebody. Then he called a pitching coach. Like, it was, you know, they had three different versions of the story. So I don't even know what to believe at this point. I can't believe this, that I was trying to think about this. All right, is Clayton Kershaw, Zach Greinke, or David Price, or Cole Hamels, or any of the other top pitchers on any other team, do you think they showed up late for their workouts for the postseason?
Not that I'm aware. Hell no.
Not that I can think of. You know, this is it's a joke. And listen. When I was here in 06 with the Mets, Pedro Martinez was habitually late. I mean, every home game he was late. But the one time he wasn't late was the postseason. Like, he did not miss postseason workouts or games.
Interesting.
At least it happened in a small market. So if the Mets lose out, it's not going to be much of a story.
Yeah,
it's not going to get blown out of proportion in New York. No.
Not at all.
I mean, are we at the point now where you have to think, you know, there's something wrong here? You know, I hate to say Harvey's a bad guy. I don't know him personally. I'm sure he has redeeming qualities. But, you know, are we getting close to that?
Well, I mean, I think it's, you know, fair to say. I think the organization's obviously trying to downplay it, and they should. But, yeah, I think you do worry about it at some point because you see too many of these things, too many of these issues, you know, continuing to happen time and time again. It happened, you know, even, you know, if you remember back when he was going through the rehab, from Tommy John surgery, he was having issues where he would show up at Yankee Stadium for a game. That's almost a no-no if you're a Met player.
Yike.
You know, and he was going to see a Derek Jeter game, but, you know, he would certainly the nightlife, he was enjoying the nightlife a little bit too much. Now, we haven't seen as many of those stories this year. Those have kind of died down, but now they percolate back up. You know, we already know the whole Scott Boras thing, and yeah, it does make you wonder, you know, now a little bit more about him. And let's just say this. We know he's not the brightest bear in the woods, but I think from that perspective, you know, he's going to have to pitch extremely well. He keeps digging the holes for himself and putting an awful lot of pressure on his performance you know, where if he let's say he doesn't pitch well, he has no real margin of error with the fan base here.
With Jim Duquette of MLB Network, you may think this is an unfair comparison, but a week ago, the Papelbon issue. And I've talked to I don't know how many people since then, and I've asked a variety of people, would you be inclined, you know, first of all, do you think Washington wants to keep Papelbon? And the definitive answer is no. The next question is, can you move him? Does anybody else want to take a chance on this guy? Big salary and this issue. And the answer is, wow, I don't know.
Not likely.
About Harvey? At what point is he now hurting his rep? If you're a general manager someplace and you're looking at, well, maybe free agent signing going to cost me a lot of money at some point, blah, blah, blah. Are you balking now maybe at looking at him?
Well, I do think it raises a lot of concerns. There's no doubt about it. He's 26, I want to say. So you know that there's an immaturity there in some ways.
Yeah.
The only thing is he's got 3 more years left in his contract before he's a free agent. So you're hoping.
I got that.
You know, if you're the Mets, you're hoping, okay, he's got to figure this thing out and you know, he pitches better. And then, you know, there's no way the Mets are going to re-sign this guy at the end of his contract. So I look at it that way. We were trying to sit there and try to compare similar players, similar high-profile players who had issues. We were coming up with Daryl Strawberry back in '80s, in the mid to late '80s.
Yeah.
And not that Matt has the drug issues that Daryl had, but if you remember, outside of the drug issues, Daryl Strawberry was habitually late. He had a lot of issues behind the scenes, and his teammates at one point just got fed up. And Keith Hernandez was ready to pop him in spring training, turn the picture tape. And so that to me was maybe the better description was, his teammates are getting sick of having the answer for him, and at some point I wouldn't be surprised if somebody popped him.
Well, is that kind of what the only thing the Mets can do is hope one of their players pop him? Because you mentioned he's got 3 years left. Like, the Mets front office really doesn't have any leverage here, do they?
Wait a second, I got the answer. Mets need to trade for Papelbon.
Papelbon for Harvey straight up?
No.
Or Harvey chokes him?
No.
Papelbon chokes Harvey.
Yeah, put the two of them together.
Right. So you want enforcers in baseball.
Right there.
Yeah, Pier 6 brawl. Yeah.
But
listen, to answer your question on the front office side of things, they don't have it. I mean, you're not going to release the guy. He's too good of a talent.
Right.
No, I get that.
But here's what ends up happening. He's like, okay, he becomes like the guy who comes into camp overweight. Or the guy who, you have to spend more time and attention making sure of these things. You gave him the benefit of the doubt. He lost your trust, and now you have to spend an inordinate amount of time babysitting the kid. And at some point, I know this, patience wears out, and yet you're like, oh, you know what, it's not worth it. Let's try to figure out how we trade him. And then you're trying to find a partner from there. I don't know if it's not going to be at the end of this year. Next year, I think he's going to be one of the front runners to be, in Cy Young consideration. Maybe it's after he has a big year and hopefully he doesn't have any problems. It's one of those things that's just hard to predict. I wouldn't be surprised if that ending happens.
It's interesting. Alex Anthopoulos has been on with us several times in the last little while. Well, he's on with us all the time anyway, but he made the point that he realized after 6 years the importance of that group of guys, those 25 guys in the room, and they had to be they had to get along. They had to be of a certain character. He went out and got good players without question at the trade deadline.
Right.
But he got the kind of guys that he wanted, guys that he thought would fit, would get along. And all we hear from these players is how happy they are with their 24 teammates. And that's got to mean something. I mean, I know they're talented, but it's got to mean something.
Well, it does. It does. And I think that, they had some talented teams, but they didn't have this kind of talent, first off. But second of all, they didn't have this type of, this term gets overused a lot in baseball, the guys that grind out at bats on the offensive side, right? But you have guys that set a tone. Like, Donaldson is about as competitive of a guy as you can find. Same thing with Martin. And when you put those type of guys in your clubhouse at the beginning of the season like they did, the guys who are, let's say, on the bubble, they kind of go along. I think Bautista was looking for somebody like that, too. And sometimes if you're the lone wolf or one of the lone people there, that gets frustrating, too. So now you surround the guys in the clubhouse with more of those type of guys. yeah, I'm not saying that you could predict the success. You got to have talent, like you mentioned, but it definitely helps when things are, you know, looking like the wheel's going to fall off, let's say. And that's why I've always felt that makeup was underrated, not overrated. And a lot of these sabermetric guys who don't really put much of an emphasis on it, I'm like, well, you've never been in a major league clubhouse before, because it really does matter, because you're together for so long.
Oh my God,
the course of the season.
I'm glad you said that, Jim, because I didn't want the hate tweets if I had to say it, you know.
Well, they can hate tweet me if they like it.
They can hate tweet, that's for sure. I guess still in New York, Yankees and Astros, is this CC Sabathia thing much of a distraction for the Yankees?
I know it was a big surprise. You know, the way, you know, things happen in New York, what happens with the Yankees a lot of times is they have so many of these type things. They've almost become experts on how to handle it, you know. So I don't think it's – I think once, today got here, they had tried to put it behind them a little bit. But the problem that they have is, all right, beyond today, let's say they're able to advance, and I think it's going to be tough for them to do it. But he was their second-best pitcher in terms of, you know, how he had pitched in September. And if you look at August, he was starting to turn around in August. Like, I looked at him like, geez, he might be their number two starter right now just because he had pitched well in September. So, you know, it does create some problems for them if they advance. And, you know, I think that there is definitely a lot of surprise around the team, certainly around the management there after he had his news.
Well, you would agree. I mean, the news itself was surprising. The timing of the decision is stunning.
Well, and it makes you wonder. Here's the one thing. We've all been around the game long enough to know this, and it's a serious thing, and it's a disease, and we all get that. But I feel like we don't know the whole story.
Yeah.
There's some other thing that's going on behind the scenes that we don't know about, and maybe comes out a little bit later. And I don't know what that is.
I think you're right.
You know, we can all speculate, but you know, that part of it, I wonder. It doesn't seem like, you know, from a timing standpoint, that this is the only thing the only reason why he's doing it when he is.
Does Dallas Keuchel on 3 days rest on the road concern you if you're a Houston Astro?
I think so. Mm-hmm. I do. It concerns me a little bit, and I'll tell you why. Well, especially because you haven't done it. There's a really good article in the Wall Street Journal today about sinker ball pitchers. And if you go look at it, I think they went back to 1987. They defined sinker ballers as, you know, 55% ground ball rate or higher. And I think there's only 27 of them.
Wow.
But their earned run average is like in the mid-2s. So, you know, the sinker ball pitchers, they tend to pitch better because they're obviously getting a lot of ground balls. They're pitching contact, and that's what you have to do when you're pitching on 3 days rest. Your stuff isn't quite as crisp, but you still have, a lot of times, sinker ballers still have that good life. So it's something to watch, I think, early tonight when we're watching is, okay, are they making solid contact? The Yankees making solid contact. Is he picking in the zone, you know, and afraid of contact, or is he able to command his pitches? And so that's really the unknown. But I think, you know, when you look at it from a historical perspective, he's more likely to pitch better on 3 days rest than maybe a power pitcher.
Mm-hmm. Real quickly, before we let you go, who do you like, Yankees, Astros, and who do you think Kansas City's, I won't say rooting for, but who would they prefer to play, do you think?
I think Kansas City would prefer to play the Yankees, because I think their rotation's a little bit more in question now.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually like the Astros tonight because of Keuchel, because of the matchups with their offense. If you look at with Tanaka against some of the guys in the lineup, Correa, Chris Carter, Altuve have all hit home runs off of Tanaka, and I don't know what you're going to get out of Tanaka tonight. So I'm going to pick, I guess Astros would be considered the underdog. I'm going to pick Houston, and I think actually Kansas City would rather play the Yankees.
Jim, it's great of you to take time for us. Thanks, pal. We'll talk again, I hope.
Anytime.
Bye-bye. Jim Duquette of MLB Network, as we take you through the Matt Harvey situation, kind of set you up for tonight a little bit with the Yankees and the Astros. Ken Rosenthal will join us later. He is in New York for that game, which I guess will be televised by Fox.
Do you think the New York Post goes with Harvey on the one page and the results of the game tonight on the other on the front page? Because they had a double cover of CC Sabathia today. It wasn't very nice.
I can't even begin to think of what the Post is going to do.
I know. If the Yankees lose, and then they're going to go deep on the Sabathia thing. If the Mets ultimately lose, they're going to go deep on
well,
the
that's
Harvey
another day.
Thing. It's another day. Exactly.
It's another day, and more space will be available.
It always is.
We're going to shuffle things up a little bit. Don Banks is going to join us next. Is that correct? Banks from SI. Seahawks beat the Lions, but did they impress you at all?
And at least,
or
the,
do you think you could get 10 friends and beat the Lions?
And at least the ending wasn't, you know, controversial or anything like that.
We'll talk about it when Primetime continues on the Sportsnet radio and television networks.
This ain't like when you're at a game and sign up for a credit card just to get the prize and then you immediately cancel the credit card. Because there's no prize when you sign up for our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Now, more of Bob McCowan and Primetime Sports on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Twenty-two minutes before the hour, McCown and Reed in our Toronto studios. Do we have the videotape of the closing play or the big play at the end of the game last night, Seahawks against the Lions? So Johnson is going in for the touchdown. Don't play it yet. Hang on a sec. I'll give you a cue. So Johnson's going in for a touchdown.
Mm-hmm.
DB
Cam Chancellor comes up from behind him,
bats the ball out of his hands.
Right.
Ball goes into the end zone.
Correct.
And it's kind of bouncing around in there.
Correct.
Another player.
KJ Wright.
Comes up.
From Seattle.
And bats the ball.
Out of the end of the end zone.
Out of the back of the end zone. Here's the play. Watch it just so you know what exactly took place. There's the pass going in for the touchdown. Oh,
okay,
ball comes out.
Okay, now watch him bat it out. It's pretty flagrant. Line judge is right there at the back. Loose ball and boop. I'm just going to bat that out.
I'm just
KJ
gonna
Wright
touch
just
it,
takes care
and
of
it. And it goes out.
Yep, and watch, there's your line judge watching it. Got a pretty good eye of things. Okay.
Seems pretty clear to me.
Not supposed to be.
Now, the question becomes, well, let's bring our guest in.
Right. Let's bring Don.
Don Banks of Sports Illustrated is with us. So, Banks, number one, did you know the rule?
No, I did not. I did not know that was a violation when I watched it live. And apparently Pete Carroll didn't either. John Gruden didn't either. There's a heck of a lot of us in this club.
And this is all well and good, and I don't pretend to know the rule, although I didn't see it live. I'd like to think that I would have raised a Spocky an eyebrow and said, wait a second, should you be able to do that? But here's what I do think. I think those groups of guys, that group of guys in striped shirts who make their living, at least in part, by knowing the rules, ought to have known that one.
Well, look, that was my first instinct, too, and watching it live, I actually did raise an eyebrow, and I remember thinking, huh, I wonder if you can do that. But I saw no flag. I heard no flag called. So I don't think my first gut was exactly as you said, Bob. I tweeted. I said, this is another indication of how dense and complicated the NFL rule book is, that even the guys paid to officiate don't know the rules. I actually think he did know the rule. I don't think it was a matter of them not knowing the rules. Clearly, a lot of the rest of us, a lot of the players, a lot of the coaches, a lot of the commentators didn't. What I think was he made the call, and this is what I don't understand. The rule seems written very black and white. It doesn't sound like it has room for interpretation built into it. But as Dean Blandino, the director of officials, later commented, he said that the back judge ruled that it was not overt, i.e. intentional. I didn't think there was intentional written into the rule. It was either you can't bat the ball out, and that's why I'm confused, and that's why I think a lot of people were confused with the explanation. So in this case, I think they knew the rule. I don't think they applied it correctly, and the league agrees with that stance.
Yeah, the only thing that's similar, and I mentioned this to Kenny earlier, and I mean it's a long time ago, 1991 Grey Cup, Argonauts are playing Calgary. And Harry Aboff kicked a ball out of bounds on a punt return. The ball was just lying there, and it was like a foot away from the sideline. So Harry just kind of, poof, kicked it out of bounds, figuring we'll get the ball at that point. Well, no. When you do that, the other team gets possession. And that's essentially what the rule would have been here, that Detroit would have got the football on the one-yard line if they'd called it according to the rules, correct?
Correct. If it was called, yes, as the rule is written, it should have been a Detroit ball at less than the one-yard line, which, you know, you can argue. Some people say that it's a nonsensical rule, that the fumble is, in effect, a turnover and should be reviewed. Well, the turnover can, but the illegal bat, as they kept calling the rule last night, cannot be reviewed. And that's where my argument is. Bill Belichick is right. Everything should be reviewable.
Wow, yeah.
Because when New York has the ability, meaning the league office and the headquarters of the officiating replay booth, when they have the ability to correct a mistake in real time and make sure that game does not end with an injustice, they should do that. They shouldn't have to throw up their hands and say, this play is not reviewable, therefore we're going to have to sit back and take this one and watch it. And I think that's where we're eventually headed. It will not mean a replay review on every play, like I've heard people to say, 5-6 hour games. That's garbage. We're talking about the plays where the game, I believe, will swing and the league knows there's a mistake, but the refs can't review it.
Well, it's interesting. The National Hockey League instituted replay basically initially on all scoring plays. It was
right.
Only scoring plays. And most leagues thought, you know, that's the right way to do it. Technically, would this have been a scoring play?
No.
See, that's the thing, isn't it?
All scoring plays are reviewed in the NFL.
So, Don, do you figure they're just going to add this one to the list once the offseason comes around?
They're going to add it, and it will continue the piecemeal, reactive competition committee stance of many years. And I think they have to be, at some point, they have to stop just cobbling more, you know, Play-Doh on the wall and rebuild the wall and go through and either take out all the plays that could possibly haunt the NFL on the lack of replay capability and give us the ability to not have a game-turning play like that and then have the league say it was wrong, we're sorry, Detroit Lions, but we couldn't do anything about it because it's not reviewable.
My first instinct was I would have bet it was a safety.
Right.
How about this one? If that official had called it a safety, therefore it is a scoring play, would it have been reviewable?
Theoretically, I guess it would have. All scoring plays are reviewable in the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if the ball goes out the back like that, I don't believe it is a safety. I think it's Seahawks ball. If KJ Wright hadn't touched it, it's not a safety.
Oh, no, I get that.
Yeah.
But the issue would have been, was there a change in possession if the player deliberately bats the ball out of bounds?
Right.
And
if it was ruled a safety. Yeah.
And if there's a possession change and you deliberately go out, then I think it's a safety.
Yeah.
Anyway,
don't.
It's crazy. I saw the linebacker, and I thought, why didn't he just grab it? But then he said he was coached to not try to recover it because he might fumble it back to the Lions and therefore do the smart thing, as he said, and bat it out.
Pete yeah, well, that's a dumb coach.
Today. He didn't know.
No one knew.
He didn't know that rule.
Yeah.
He's actually coached to do an illegal thing because no one really knows it's illegal. So Don, my question is to you, and you mentioned the Play-Doh way that the NFL is kind of doing this on replay. What's going to put it over the top for them? Because it's not like this happened on a nationally televised game last night or anything like that.
and the irony is, obviously, one of the biggest debacles in officiating, which did cause action, was also in Seattle on a Monday night game in 2012, the Fail Mary. I guess just enough of a tipping point or a body of evidence that they have to relent. You know, a lot of people say, well, then coaches are throwing flags to make, you know, in a futile attempt to see if they can find a holding call, which you can find on every play. Well, that's hyperbole. Coaches still get two challenges. I think this is going, if they take away the that play's not reviewable, then we're never in the situation where New York and the Central Command Center sits there and says, we know a mistake just happened and we can't fix it because that play is not reviewable.
Well, and that's the wrong philosophy, right? I mean, we have replays to fix those mistakes. That's why we have them.
Egregious errors corrected in real time was the whole point of replay.
Correct.
If that was not an egregious error last night in real time that could have been corrected, then
we're all missing it.
I think the other thing about that play is if the official did make the call based on what he thought the rule was, I mean, how do you think that's not an overt act on the part of KJ Wright?
I think he choked and said, I'm not calling that.
Right.
To turn this game around in Seattle with this crowd. It was an amazing play by Cam Chancellor, and that has gotten lost in all this. It was an incredibly game-saving, savvy,
you bet it was,
heads-up play, and that's lost in that the rule interpretation or the rule was blown. And I think in real time, that back judge did quick math in his head. They even huddled. I mean, they even huddled briefly and talked about this. And for whatever reason, the back judge said he did not see an overt action. I don't know how you can watch that. If he would have gotten a chance to watch it again on replay or someone did, they would have come to the conclusion that, of course, he was batting it out of the back of the end zone.
He was almost casual about it, too. He wasn't whacking at it. He knew exactly what he was doing and the way he guided
it out
with his hand.
Yeah,
and he admitted in the postgame is exactly what he was trying to do. So he refuted what the official tried to sell as an explanation for the non-call.
I don't want to wade too deep into this. It's week four after all. But my sense is the Seattle Seahawks might be in a bit of trouble. You know, I know they won. I know they won the game. I think they're 2-2 now, aren't they?
Yes.
And I get there shouldn't necessarily be any panic. But I know that this team had everybody had high expectations for this team. They really haven't played very well overall so far. If you're a Seattle Seahawks fan, should you be concerned? Do you have reason to be concerned?
Absolutely. I agree 100%. I think that offensive line, I think Russell Wilson has been sacked something on pace for 72. So what would that be, about 18 sacks?
18
in four
sacks
games?
So far, yeah.
Yep.
And where's Jimmy Graham in this offense? They have yet to figure that out, which was their centerpiece acquisition, that long sought after tight end that they've never really had doing damage in the middle of the field. And I also, look, I hate to make this simplistic. I just don't think this team is going to get out from under the specter of that Super Bowl loss anytime this year. It's not. I'm not saying they're not going to the playoffs. I'm not saying they're not formidable if they do get to the playoffs. But I do. I think there's just a toll that is going to be taken on that team. I think it's already appeared at times, and I think everything's going to be a struggle for Seattle this year.
Don, good if you take time for us, as always. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Don.
Don Banks of Sports Illustrated. Well, it was a bizarre play.
Mm-hmm.
I think officials have to know the rules. I think you have 7 or 8 guys out there. At least one of them has to know what that rule is and be able to go over, even if the official that was on at the back of the end zone missed the call. Somebody's got to go over and say, wait a second.
That's just that. When a sport has multiple officials, much like you see in baseball, and you flagrantly see, okay, that's the wrong call. They get together, cover for your buddy. For your umpiring friend or for your official friend and say, look, you got that one wrong. All of us guys agree you blew that. We're just going to say, you know, take one here for the team. Made the wrong call. It's going to hurt right now. But at the end, we're not going to have this the day after with everyone talking about this.
When we come back, Ken Rosenthal of Fox Sports joins us. The Yankees and Astros, he's covering that game for Fox tonight. And just some general playoff predictions. Does he think your Toronto Blue Jays will go all the way? Some do, some don't. Cassie Campbell-Pascal will join us a little bit later on from the NHL on Sportsnet. And for those of you who missed it, we had a lengthy and a reasonably interesting chat with the manager of the Toronto Blue Jays, John Gibbons, who more or less gave away pretty much the entire roster.
What?
Even though he kept saying, I can't tell you. We'll replay that for you, for those of you who missed it about 2 hours ago. That's ahead. This is Primetime on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Networks.